toward the former, partly because I wouldn't expect a drug to cure me any more than I expect running to. Also, for me, there's not a clear difference between the two goals. If I'm sad less often, I tend to function better in everyday life. The biggest criticism about antidepressants' effectiveness is that, especially in cases of mild depression, they're either only slightly more or no more effective than placebos. That is, people on an antidepressant may report no more reductions in symptoms than might people taking a placebo. Given the side effects that can accompany antidepressants, such as sexual dysfunction and weight changes, some experts have concluded that the risks outweigh the benefits. It's important to remember that a placebo effect is still an effect. When I told clinical psychiatrist and runner Brian Vasey about Salazar's quick reaction to Prozac, he said, "I wouldn't dispute that he felt better in 3 days. The placebo effect is pretty powerful." This line of thinking should be familiar to runners. Say you committed to getting half an hour more sleep on weeknights in your build-up to your last half marathon, and that you ran faster in that half than in your previous one, despite your training being similar. Did the extra sleep help? Better stated, did sleeping more allow you to better absorb and recover from your training, and therefore improve your fitness come race day? Or was it the idea of the extra sleep? Look how dedicated I am to this race, going to bed earlier to prepare for it, that really made the difference. In the latter scenario, the regular reminder that you were trying to get better could create a positive feedback loop. You tell yourself you're recovering better, so you push a little harder in your workouts, and progress there motivates you to eat a little better, and losing a couple of pounds makes your long runs feel better, and nailing your long runs gets you excited about race day, and so on. The same sort of self-reinforcing cycle is possible with antidepressants. Telling yourself that you're finally doing something about your condition, in this case, taking medication, can be the catalyst for improving that condition. In this vein, it's interesting to note that in trials of antidepressants, placebo effects have greatly increased over time. That increase coincides with growing societal acceptance of the drugs. If you know more people who say they feel better after starting on antidepressants, and if there's less stigma with antidepressants than there used to be, it's possible that a placebo effect is more likely. How do antidepressants affect running? Salazar's story from the mid-1990s made the potential performance-enhancing benefits of antidepressants a common topic in running for a while. While cautioning about such benefits for all the reasons we're about to see, Ekakakis says, theoretically speaking, it would make some sense. There are a lot of indications that serotonin is involved in fatigue, and therefore if you optimize serotonin neurotransmission, it could theoretically change the sense of tiredness. But as Ekakakis told me while we discussed health research in general, how taking antidepressants for their prescribed reasons affects the training and racing of everyday runners isn't the sort of topic that gets priority funding. The pharmaceutical companies that make the medications focus their research on such things as the drug's effectiveness in treating various conditions, relatively benign common side effects, and uncommon but potentially dangerous side effects. Other health researchers need to convince grant providers that their area of inquiry meets an important public health need. Whether Wellbutrin makes a 53-year-old recreational runner like me a little faster or slower in his next race isn't considered vital. The executive summary is that what research there has been is equivocal. There's no mountain of evidence showing that antidepressants significantly improve or decrease exercise performance. Why the uncertainty? One thing about serotonin is you can find people who say the higher the serotonin, the higher the sense of fatigue. And you can find people who say the higher the level, the lower the sense of fatigue, Ekakakis says. So exactly how the serotonin levels and what area of the brain are related to fatigue is unclear. What appears to be clear is that there's some involvement, But that's about the extent of it. Further adding to the lack of clarity, many of the studies have used a smaller number of subjects, which can make extrapolating from them to the population as a whole unreliable. Most of the subjects in the studies were men. Their results wouldn't necessarily be duplicated by women. Some studies have used as subjects athletes who wouldn't merit an antidepressant prescription in real life. Some studies look at elements of exercise performance after a single dosage, which is, of course, not necessarily the same as being on an antidepressant for the rest of your life. Some studies use the maximum safe dosage of an antidepressant, so any effect could be different than at the lower dosage most people take. The motivation behind some of these studies is to see whether antidepressants impart enough of a performance benefit to merit falling under anti-doping regulations in elite sport. As is often the case in the lab, many studies use cycling rather than running as the form of exercise. Some of the studies have all of these elements. They look at the performance of a small number of male cyclists who don't need an antidepressant after a single, safe, maximum dosage. Another caveat is that by necessity, studies use one antidepressant. Even an unambiguous finding about, say, Paxil's effect on core body temperature during hard exercise isn't necessarily transferable to Prozac or Wellbutrin or Lexapro. And before we look at specific studies, it's important to remember just how complex a system your body on the run is. A change in one measurable parameter, such as core body temperature, may or may not result in better or worse performance. Conversely, sometimes lab studies find differences in performance between two conditions, even when variables such as blood glucose levels and carbohydrate metabolism are the same. This ambiguity can be frustrating if you're looking for clear black and white answers, but it's heartening for those of us who consider running performance more than the predictable outcome of a series of quantifiable inputs. Studies on endurance performance tend to use either time trials, how fast you can complete a given distance, or time to exhaustion trials, how long you can sustain a given exercise intensity. Time trials are generally more applicable to the real world. They're a solo simulation of racing. While few of us encounter situations where we run at a set pace for as long as possible and then stop when we have to slow. When the studies have been conducted in normal environmental conditions, Prozac, Paxil, Celexa, and Wellbutrin have not improved time trial or time to exhaustion performance. In one study, the more aerobically fit subjects performed significantly worse on a time-to-exhaustion cycling trial after taking a single 20 milligram dose of Paxil. There has been research indicating that a single large dose, 300 milligrams, considered the maximum safe amount, of Zyban improves performance in very hot conditions. Zyban is a brand name for bupropion, which is what's also in Wellbutrin. In one study done in conditions of 86 degrees Fahrenheit and 48% humidity, men rode almost 5% faster in a cycling time trial when they took that maximal dosage of Zyban instead of a placebo. A similar study with women duplicated the findings. The performance benefit didn't follow more normal doses, 150 or 225 milligrams. Of note, is that after all the Zyban time trials, the subject's core temperature was higher. At the end of the maximum dose trial, their heart rate was higher, which makes sense given that they wound up riding faster. The researchers wrote, "Despite an increase in core temperature and improved performance in the maximal dose, there was no change in perceived effort and thermal sensation, suggesting an altered motivation or drive to continue." Again, though, this was a single safe maximum dose given to people who didn't necessarily merit a prescription. That's more the stuff of doping than real-world relevance. When the same researchers repeated the study after subjects took Zyban for 10 days, the performance benefit wasn't duplicated. and the subject's core temperature wasn't as high as during the single-dosage study. It seems that chronic administration results in an adaptation of central neurotransmitter homeostasis, resulting in a different response to the drug, the researchers wrote. Probably the more important finding stemming from that research is the increase in core temperature after taking Zyban. A study involving Paxil in warm conditions also found an increase in core temperature. In the Zyban study, the finding that the athlete's thermal sensation didn't change means that they didn't feel hotter despite a higher core temperature. Such a mismatch could lead to the improved performance seen in the acute study, but it could also lead to problems if you're doing a long run on an 85-degree day and don't feel warm, even though your core temperature is approaching a dangerous level. Heat intolerance is among the potential side effects listed for some antidepressants, including Wellbutrin and other brands of bupropion. We'll return to this matter later in the chapter. So far, we've looked at research on how antidepressants might affect your running. This field of inquiry, how drugs affect the body, is known as pharmacodynamics. But what about flipping the equation? Are there ways in which being a runner can affect the antidepressant you might be taking? Might runners need different dosages than sedentary people? After all, prescriptions often take into account physical traits of the patient, such as age, weight, ethnicity, and pregnancy status. Given that exercise is often recommended in conjunction with other treatments for depression and anxiety, and given that many of us are self-medicating with running, the issue of whether regular running might alter an antidepressant's efficacy is hardly esoteric. Unfortunately, the relevant research on what's known as pharmacokinetics, how bodies affect drugs, is even more scant concerning antidepressants and athletes. One of the few people to investigate the issue is Ethan Ruderman. For his master's thesis in kinesiology at the University of Toronto, Ruderman examined whether exercise appeared to affect bodily processing of a single dose of sertraline, most commonly known by the brand name Zoloft. Ruderman had 14 men in their 20s take 100 milligrams of sertraline on two occasions, at least 2 weeks apart, once while resting and once before cycling for 30 minutes at a moderate intensity. Ruderman collected blood samples over the ensuing 48 hours. When the men exercised after taking the medication, the elimination half-life of the drug changed. That is, it remained in their body longer. Part of the explanation for this finding could be differences in blood flow when we're resting versus working out. When you run, blood is diverted from some body parts to working muscles to supply them with more oxygen, and the skin to help with cooling. That phenomenon is why it can be unpleasant to run too soon after eating. The usual blood flow to your stomach is reduced, so food just sits there instead of being digested. When you run, there's also a lot less blood going to your liver, which plays a key role in metabolizing medications. It's possible, then, running could slow the rate at which you metabolize antidepressants, or other medications for that matter. It's also possible that long-term changes brought on by being a runner, such as greater density of the tiny blood vessels known as capillaries and lower body fat concentration, could affect how a drug makes its way through your body. Ruderman is careful not to make definitive statements about the implications of his study. Instead, he hopes his work will spur more research on and awareness of how exercise might affect medication's effectiveness. Both the acute bouts of exercise and the fact that people might be a marathoner with a very different fitness status should be included in the conversation, along with height, weight, age, ethnicity, when you're talking about dosage, he says. In my work as a running journalist and book author, I often read research on exercise performance. A big takeaway from decades of doing that is that exercise science is sometimes most helpful in explaining what runners already do, as opposed to discovering what runners should do. For example, runners were doing tempo runs, 3 to 6 miles at a comfortably hard pace, somewhere between 15-kilometer and marathon race pace, long before exercise scientists delineated that these runs can improve your ability to clear lactate, an adaptation that helps you hold a strong pace for longer. That's how I think about the current state of research on running and antidepressants. We runners will figure it out in the ultimate lab of daily road work. Ideally, researchers will one day explain the why. But for now, the best we have to go on are one another's experiences. So, here is mine and those of several fellow runners. My experience as a runner on antidepressants. I first saw a psychiatrist in early 1995. I later learned he wasn't accepting new patients, but as a runner, he was intrigued about working with the editor of Running Times, the magazine I was then the editor of. Before the end of our initial session, he said I was a good candidate for an antidepressant. I was initially prescribed Zoloft. Like Salazar, I felt almost immediate effects, but of the opposite sort, a near catatonic haze that made me feel like I was pawing through a stream of molasses. For several days, I canceled all work and social plans and spent almost all my time in bed. Almost. I got out for a dutiful 3-mile jog each day. The severity of the haze eventually lessened, but never disappeared. And after a month, I started cycling off Zoloft. Next, I tried Prozac. Within a month, 3 long-time features of my dysthymia abated. First, I slept better. Pre-Prozac, I woke several times a night, usually with one or more of those occurrences lasting for a while. While awake, I would cram a day's worth of rumination into a half an hour. What is the point of going about my business tomorrow? Why is everything so hard? Why can't I enjoy life the way others seem to? Is this how it's going to be the next 50 years? Once I was on Prozac, those incidents continued, but weren't as frequent because I wasn't awake every hour. Second, Prozac seemed to do its trademark thing of eliminating the lowest lows. My 1,000-yard stare days, when it felt as if a backhoe loader had scraped out the happier parts of my brain and left a pit, almost entirely went away. Finally, for the preceding several years, I'd often felt like one of those figurine toys held together by string that collapse when you push on the bottom. Being on Prozac, I told my psychiatrist, made me feel tauter, more efficient in navigating the world, that nobody was pressing on the bottom of the string toy. Interesting, he replied. You're the second person this week to mention those toys. Side effects seemed minimal. I lost a pound or two, unnecessary but not detrimental for a 130-pounder, and my libido dropped, overall a welcome change for a single 31-year-old man without a girlfriend. I waited for a Salazar-esque running resurgence, but it never came, even with markedly better sleep. In fact, the only discernible effect on my running was negative. Once on Prozac, I stopped digging down that last 1 or 2% in the final third of races. After the first few times it happened, I wondered whether the phenomenon was physiological or psychological. With more time on the medication, I decided it was the latter. As I said, Prozac lopped off my lowest lows, which was much appreciated. The price for that was paid from the other end of the spectrum. I also lost my highest highs. Prozac made me more nonchalant, less intense about pretty much everything, including, I realized, whether I ran that weekend's 5K 7 seconds faster. Several years later, Olympian Adam Goucher reported the same running reaction to an antidepressant. Goucher eventually said that, as a professional athlete, he couldn't justify that effect, and went off the medication. In my early 30s, and very focused on my work when I went on Prozac, I knew I was a few years past setting my last personal record. I decided any trade-off of racing a little slower for overall life improvement was worth it for me. I might have decided differently if I'd thought I still had some PRs in me. A side note, I never regained that lost edge, even during times I wasn't on antidepressants. One thing that did happen as soon as I started taking antidepressants, I decided to be open about it. My analogy at the time was that my father had an inherited cholesterol problem that merited medication, and I had an inherited mental health issue that merited medication. Why should I be any more coy or secretive about the treatment of my condition than my father was about his? Soon after, I wrote a short essay about my dysthymia and medication for Running Times. The reaction mainly took two forms. I heard from people thanking me for my candor, and heard from others saying I was a head case who was looking for an easy way to avoid life's problems. Both types of responses bolstered my decision to be open and potentially play a small part in reducing the stigma of mental health issues and their many forms of treatment. For the next decade and a half, I cycled on and off Prozac. Despite my cholesterol medication analogy, there was always part of me that didn't like the idea of taking a pill every day for the rest of my life. Every few years, I'd feel ready to try life without Prozac. Varying amounts of time would pass until I'd realize the balance between good enough days and too miserable days was once again out of whack, independent of the state of my running, my marriage, and other aspects of life. When I slumped into their office, no doctor ever needed convincing to write me a prescription. But each time, Prozac seemed less effective. In the spring of 2011, I started on it again. That turned out to be the last time. As I've mentioned, my dysthymia has never majorly interfered with my professional productivity. But this time, Prozac did. I'd sit in front of my laptop and watch myself not care that I didn't care I was goofing off instead of working. Deadlines came and went. Emails went unanswered. Collaborative projects arrived at my desk to die. And all I felt capable of doing was thinking, well, isn't this interesting? To be clear, I don't really like working, but I'd always been dependable. Now, I felt like a stoner. It was the first time a medication made me feel like someone other than myself. I cycled off Prozac, started taking Wellbutrin, and still do. It's had no noticeable effect on my running, good or bad. I've always been a ridiculously heavy sweater, so if Wellbutrin has made my heat tolerance worse, I'm unaware of it. I might feel differently if I lived in Texas, not Maine. More important, the medication seems to help with daily life with minimal side effects, resting heart rate increase of a few beats, occasional light sensitivity, so I'd probably stay on it even if I felt it made me a worse hot weather runner. That trade-off would be acceptable nearly 4 decades into my running career. For the foreseeable future, I'm over my trepidation about permanently being on an antidepressant. Other runners' experiences with antidepressants. There's great variance in how other runners feel on and about antidepressants. For Ryan Rathbun, an engineer from Chicago, antidepressants improved his running in the most direct way possible, by helping him get off the couch and out the door. Rathbun ran track in middle school and high school, then mostly switched to other sports, including rugby, in college. When I got out in the working world, all that exercise stuff kind of faded away, he says. There were at least 10 years where I did nothing. I grew fatter and more depressed, started drinking too much, and just slowly went downhill. I had relationship problems and an existential crisis, and hit rock bottom. His then-partner told Rathbun, "You need to change," and he agreed. Rathbun had been on antidepressants, Prozac and Wellbutrin, before, with mixed results. Working with a therapist, he started on Cymbalta, and once he got the dosage right, felt a profound difference. All the other times were, "Yeah, I'm better, but eh," he says. This one was, "Oh, this is how normal people feel? This is a lot different." After some time on the medication, Rathbun was drinking less and eating better, including no longer binge eating. He thought, "Hey, I've lost a ton of weight here. I could start exercising again." He picked a goal race and revived his running career. He's now a competitive age group racer, especially in skyscraper stairwell climbs. "It doesn't feel like I'm relying on this," he says about his current medication. "I feel like the person I always thought I was or should be." Like Rathbun, Rebecca Skocelos, a school psychologist from a Detroit suburb, started regular running only after going on antidepressants. But she says her running doesn't necessarily stem from her medications, Lexapro and Wellbutrin. "I began taking meds 3 weeks after my second child was born and began running just a few months later," she says, of taking up the sport in 2007. "I can tell you that there is no way that the meds sufficiently address all my symptoms. When I have had a really rough day, there is nothing that can help me like a good hard run. And there is no way that the immediate high and satisfaction I get from a long run is only from the meds." The biggest effect of medication on her running the 7-time marathoner notices is that she has, she says, an easier time staying motivated when the med situation is under control. Skocelos had surgery in 2016 to remove a large cancerous tumor. She increased her dosage because of increased anxiety. But, she says, running, not medication, really brought her around. "I did not feel normal again until I was back to running." Jeff Lee, an accountant from Hartsel, Alabama, says that his medication helps his running, but he discovered that's the case in a roundabout way. Lee has been on Effexor and occasionally Klonopin for more than 10 years for chronic depression and anxiety. He began running a few years ago at the age of 49 to lose weight and improve his health. Late in 2016, he decided to stop taking his medications. "I had been on it a long time, was healthier, and was running 30 to 35 miles per week, so I hoped I didn't need it anymore," he says. Within a couple of weeks, Lee reports, his mental state was what it had been a decade ago. "I can't tell I'm on it until I'm off it." He resumed taking the medications, and during the several weeks it took for them to take effect, "it was everything I could do to make myself run, but I did," Lee says. He realized, "I run more and have more interest in running while using my medicine." The intersection of Allie Nolan's running and medication is more complex. A former Runner's World colleague of mine, the Dallas resident, went on Lexapro in 2016 to address increasingly intrusive anxiety. The medication vastly improved her non-running life. "I no longer have reoccurring thoughts of doom or the feeling of being trapped," Nolan says. "Most days I can get to sleep. I also can do my work without having to take 40 breaks to make dozens of checklists. I can read again, kind of important for a writer slash editor." Things were more complicated with her running. Nolan says she has been able to enjoy her running more after going on medication, and that overall this was a welcome development. "For a very, very long time, running was the only thing that I used to manage my symptoms. That lasted until I realized I was running too much and running a lot of garbage miles, and that running itself was becoming a sort of compulsion and source of anxiety. But greater balance came with some costs in performance, especially at the end of races. I think that I am moving slower than I used to," she says. "Also, I eat a lot more cake now. Seriously, the sweet cravings are terrible. I estimate I've gained 5 pounds. In general, the problem is that I'm so relaxed about it," Nolan says. "If I miss a run, I shrug it off. I used to get really upset about missing miles and would fret about it for days. To avoid that feeling, I wouldn't skip a day. Now I'm so casual about it. I think that that might be because the run isn't carrying such weight in my mental wellness anymore. It's purely for enjoyment and fitness. Before, if I missed a run, I would feel like the world was ending. Plus, I'd feel like a failure because I missed the run. Now I guess I'm more like a normal person." Nolan says she's willing to accept the trade-offs for now, given that overall her life has improved. "But," she says, "if I ever felt too sluggish or too apathetic to run, that would be an issue. I suppose if I dipped under 12 miles per week and didn't care, I'd have my husband check my pulse to make sure I was still alive." We'll end this admittedly unscientific survey with Amelia Gappin, who has an interesting take on how antidepressants improve her running. She has always valued how her usual depressive and anxious ruminations eventually disappear when she runs, now that welcome process starts sooner. It doesn't seem to take as long into a run for the depression and anxiety to lift away, Gappin says, since starting on medication, a lot of the low-level background daily stuff is diminished, so when I go for a run, I'm starting in a much better place. Mentally, I might be starting where before I'd be at like 2 miles into a run. Opting out. In interviewing runners for this book, I heard from several who have eschewed antidepressants. Some, like Cecilia Bidwell of Tampa, Florida, don't like the idea of taking psychotropic drugs and find that their running and other practices sufficiently manage their condition. Bidwell, who has anxiety, says, "I don't mean this in any way as judgment of people who go that route, but I do think that things like SSRIs alter brain chemistry. For some people, that's necessary to get through the day. But if I can get enough sleep, if I can keep my job under control, if I can get out and run every day, I can handle all that, and life is good, and I shouldn't have to resort to something else. This is the real me, and I'm afraid medication would change my personality and make me someone I'm not." My running partner, Kristen Berry, has a similar take. When her lifelong depression became especially strong in her first year of law school, Berry tried medication, but stopped after 2 weeks. "They made me feel like I had too much caffeine, jittery, on edge, shaky," she says. "I was hesitant to take medication anyway, so it was easy to stop when I felt like I was having a bad reaction." In the 2 decades since, Berry has relied on her running. She's a 2-hour, 40-minute marathoner who twice qualified for the Olympic marathon trials, and therapy to manage her depression. When she was setting personal bests earlier this decade, some of her reluctance came from concern about how medication might affect her running. "I told her many times about how antidepressants seemed to rob me of the desire to go to the well late in races. These days," she says, "my reluctance stems from a general avoidance, if possible, of all medications. I do not like the idea of messing with my brain chemistry, even though what I am working with is not an ideal brain chemistry to have. I realize that's not a great mentality. It's kind of like ignoring a wound. I try to manage it as best as I can without meds, but if I were to have another episode like 1997, I would not be against taking them, especially now as a parent." Brian Frayne, a mutual fund analyst from Milwaukee, is uneasy about the bodily effects of medication, and not just antidepressants. "I'm concerned about altering my body's chemistry," he says. "I've always been averse to any medication. I don't even take aspirin. I understand that medications are designed to help, but I'm always concerned about how things will interact long term. Antidepressants in general can be extremely powerful, and the long-term side effects can't be known at this time. I worry about them throwing my entire system off balance, which will undoubtedly hurt my running in the end." Another of my running partners, Heather Johnson, also tries to avoid medications of any type, despite a lifetime of sometimes severe anxiety. "One of the biggest reasons I haven't really gone down the med route is that I have a fear of side effects. I don't really take anything, including herbal remedies," she says. When I asked her what would constitute unacceptable interference from medication in her running, she said, "Within reason, I'd say anything is unacceptable interference. Running is my sanity. I have to put it first and realize that it helps me cope with so much. I'm a better mom, wife, and friend if I run." A true experiment of one. All of the aforementioned, antidepressants' effectiveness versus their side effects, how medication might affect your running, and runners' varying experiences with antidepressants, underlies the lack of black-and-white rules on how to proceed here. Common side effects of antidepressants, such as weight gain or loss, dry mouth, and drowsiness, as well as rarer ones, such as heat intolerance, could be more significant for you as a runner than for a sedentary person. And unlike a sedentary person, you'll need to consider the balancing act between help from a medication and how it might hurt the self-medication known as your running. If you're lucky, you'll find a doctor knowledgeable enough and willing to account for your running when considering a prescription. A 2016 survey of members of the International Society for Sports Psychiatry found that such doctors exist. On the whole, these physicians say they tended to favor medications that are relatively more energizing and less likely to cause sedation, weight gain, cardiac side effects, and tremor. The doctors were surveyed about medications for a variety of mental health conditions, rather than just depression and anxiety. Prescribing preferences for athletes diverged from many of the prescribing trends seen for patients within the general population, in keeping with the assumption that different factors are considered when prescribing for athletes versus the general population, the authors of the survey concluded. Brian Vasey says that for all of his patients, he first explores whether they've responded to alternative treatments. If he decides medication is warranted, he tries to address the most significant symptoms with minimal side effects. For runners, Vasey says, SSRIs like sertraline, brand name Zoloft, fluoxetine, Prozac, and citalopram, Celexa, can potentially negatively affect motivation. I would have a conversation with the athlete about the risks of taking one of these and that he or she might feel less driven, but might feel less sad, depressed, or anxious. Vasey counsels patients in the early days of taking antidepressants. Give the medicine a little bit of time to see how it goes, because often side effects lessen over time. I see side effects lessening for some after 10 to 14 days, just about the time when the positive and hoped-for medical effects are beginning to be seen. Generally, though, for full benefits, we need to wait 4 to 6 weeks. If side effects are intolerable, I would not be hesitant to stop and switch medicines. If you do decide to try antidepressants, it's worth remembering that they're usually most effective as part of a multi-tier approach. As a runner, you already have a key form of symptom management. But there are others worth exploring as well. In the next several chapters, we'll look at the intersection of running and several non-pharmaceutical forms of treatment for depression and anxiety. Chapter 6. Running and Talk Therapy. A friend of mine's third date with her now husband was a run, a great way to turbocharge getting to know someone. Despite the popular perception of runners as taciturn loners, we love sharing the miles. Well, most of us do. My friend's husband told her after their date that he prefers to run solo. Key to that appeal are the conversations we have when running with others. One of the most interesting things about those conversations is how naturally they come about. Even when meeting someone for the first time, I don't have the "what will we talk about" worries before a run that I do before sedentary social outings. Another interesting thing about talking on the run is that you frequently find yourself discussing the most personal issues, relationships, work, family, and for good measure, the meaning of life. Doing so can feel safer, and the words often come out better when you're running than at other times. Those of us who have had these intimate mobile conversations, as well as professional talk therapy, have noticed their similarities. In this chapter, we'll look at how runners with depression and anxiety can best benefit from both. What is talk therapy? Talk therapy is the most common type of psychotherapy, a form of treatment provided by psychologists, psychiatrists, and licensed counselors for a broad range of mental health and other issues. When someone says they're seeing a therapist, they usually mean that they're having talk therapy sessions. Modern talk therapy is not lying on a couch recounting your dreams while an inscrutable Austrian man reminds you that sometimes a cigar is just a cigar. Talk therapy entails goal-oriented collaborative work between patient and professional to improve specific aspects of the patient's life. Therapists help patients articulate issues that are lowering their quality of life. Once key problems are defined, therapists help patients learn to think about and address those problems in research-backed ways. A common goal of talk therapy is for patients to replace old habits of thinking and doing with healthier habits. Talk therapy is well established as a frontline treatment for depression and anxiety. Many experts believe it to be more effective than medication, especially in mild to moderate cases. You might recall news stories from a few years ago that the effectiveness of talk therapy has been overstated. What was missing from many of the headlines was that the study the reports were based on concluded that talk therapy is efficacious, but not to the extent that the published literature would suggest. According to this review of research, talk therapy gives people a 20% greater chance of improvement, not a 30% chance as previously thought. I'll take those odds. One key to benefiting from talk therapy is, well, talking. Little progress is possible if you and the therapist don't have access to your core triggers for and manifestations of depression or anxiety. Runners with depression or anxiety might have a head start in talk therapy because we have so much experience examining life's issues in an intense but set duration environment. When I first saw a therapist for depression in 1995, I was immediately comfortable with being completely open. I already had more than 15 years of droning on to a captive audience, and that was with my not paying them. Why are we so chatty on the run? In Chapter 1, we saw how the free-flowing creative thinking many of us experience on runs dries up almost as soon as we stop. You've probably noticed the same thing about conversation. After a couple of miles, even the most introverted runners can open up as if they're at happy hour, only to revert to guardedness as soon as their heart rate returns to normal. I've been running with my running buddy for 7 years, and we talk about everything. But because of our schedules, that's really the only time we're together, says clinical psychologist Laura Fredendahl. Then recently, I saw her at the grocery store and was like, Hi, I like your shirt. Although running can make you smarter in your sedentary hours, some cognitive skills diminish while you run. Go ahead, see how much longer than usual it takes to do a complex math problem halfway into your next 10-miler. Fredendahl says that a similar temporary shift in the brain's activity might explain on-the-run logorrhea. Perhaps we're not as attuned to the part of the frontal lobe that manages judgment, anticipation of consequences, impulse control, she says. So, maybe you're not worried about talking about your sex life with your running buddy. There might be something to the happy hour analogy. Having a couple of beers can be like shutting down your prefrontal cortex, Fredendahl says. So, just like at a bar, on the run, that part of the brain might not manage how you talk as much as other times. Therapist Sapita Saremi adds that concentrating on the effort of running might lessen the emotional intensity of otherwise tough subjects. What happens for me is that things feel lighter, she says. Even if you're talking about something difficult, like your mother's cancer, you're not holding on to it or feeling it in the same way, because you're feeling a lot of other things in your body at the same time. It's almost like it distracts your body so that it makes it easier to tolerate talking about difficult things. Saremi also thinks the logistics of running with others, looking ahead while side by side or single file, encourages more open conversations. There's something about not having the eye contact that makes us much more relaxed and comfortable, she says. I hear from parents of teens that they get all the best information from kids in their car. Even with my friends from grad school, who are so open, it's when we went for walks or drove somewhere that I really got to know them. I think you feel less pressure talking about yourself when you don't have to look the person in the eye. There's a reason the priest doesn't look at you during confession, professional on-the-run talk sessions. Seremi has woven these insights on greater conversational openness into her work. In 2014, she started her private practice, Run, Walk, Talk, now located in Redondo Beach, California. After an initial in-office session, clients can opt to see Seremi while walking or running on an oceanside recreation path, 2 blocks from Seremi's office. The genesis of Seremi's approach came in 2012, when she was working at a community health agency. "I had a lot of male clients," she says, "and it was hard for them to talk about emotional things or difficult things when they were sitting in an office with me and looking me in the eye. So I went on walks with them, and I got so much more information. I think that was a function of being side by side and not having that sustained gaze." Seremi assures her clients that the point of their mobile sessions is therapy, not a killer workout. They walk or run only as fast as is comfortable for the client to converse. Occasionally, Seremi is in the opposite situation, with a client whose conversational pace would be difficult for her. In those cases, we talk about pace before we go out, and that the point is to use the movement to check in with the body and understand what's happening in their lives. If they find the slower pace frustrating, we explore that, Seremi says. Before heading out, Seremi and her clients also discuss confidentiality issues stemming from being outside and what to do if they bump into a client's acquaintance. Then, they head out and back on the path, with Seremi setting a timer to mark the turnaround point. "We're doing the same things we do in an office," she says. "You're telling me about what's going on in your life." Seremi doesn't take notes during office sessions, so the inability to do so while running isn't a hindrance. Seremi's clients include entrepreneurs and other driven professionals. She says that many of them value the walk or run therapy simply because they feel that combining a workout with therapy is more efficient use of their time. For others, however, being in motion allows for more effective sessions. "Sometimes it makes the therapy possible," Seremi says. They realize this feels good, or that just being outside changes their mood. That might seem obvious, but when you're in the throes of depression or anxiety, it's really hard to believe that changing your environment or changing what you're doing with your body can change how you feel. Seremi also takes what were originally office visits outside. There have been sessions with people who are really depressed and get into really negative self-talk. I'll say, "You're really in a bad place right now. I think we should go outside. Walking might help." And the thinking pattern changes. Movement and the scenery interrupts that negative flow. Fredendahl likewise conducts mobile sessions when appropriate. "I keep my running shoes in the back room," she says. "With some patients, I'll say, 'Let's go for a walk,' and we go out the back door and walk for a mile. It gets them started talking." Sometimes Fredendahl induces activity in her office. "I had a teenager who really struggles with depression," she says. "We took our pulse, we stood up, and we swung our arms back and forth, fake running for 30 seconds. We made a game out of it and kept going. She ended up smiling at the end of the session. For somebody who's really depressed, some sort of activation can be key to getting them to open up." DIY on-the-run talk sessions. "For some people, it's just a way into the relationship," Seremi says about her clients who are already runners. "The running is what allows them to feel safe in being open with Seremi." Heather Johnson, who has anxiety, echoes Seremi on this count. "Though I may only see runner friends while running, I feel most at home with them," she says. "I feel safe." Combine that bond over a shared, valued activity with the chattiness that happens naturally on the run, and you've got the perfect setting for amateur talk therapy sessions. If you're finding that value in running with friends, then there is value in that for you, Seremi says. It's not therapy, but it's certainly therapeutic. Fredendahl is also a fan of non-therapy professionals hashing things out on the run. "I think it has enormous benefits," she says. In the 1950s, women went to their hairdresser once a week. They really benefited from being able to talk to each other. Running with friends, you get that bonus of feeling good talking together, and so then you start associating running with something pleasant. When you're really depressed, that social aspect might be key to getting yourself to run and feeling better. For many of us, conversation feels most natural when we're running. Part of that is because it's natural for the conversation to be no conversation. Long stretches of silence feel much more comfortable when you're running compared to talking with the same person while sitting, or even worse, on the phone. I recall with fondness an 11-miler with a good friend in 1981, in which his okay, indicating it was safe to cross a busy road, was the only word spoken in 75 minutes. More common, of course, is the dialogue that starts 3 steps into a run with others and that ends only when you part. You might go from the weather, yesterday's tempo run, Netflix must-sees, and fears of death, to the ubiquity of leaf blowers, shoe recommendations, spousal issues, and restaurant reviews, all in the first 20 minutes, before someone, usually me, breaks the conversational chain by making a pit stop. If you've regularly run with others, scattershot chats have probably helped you through days when you're more eager for the run to be over than you are interested in the experience of the run itself. For depressed or anxious runners, these meandering conversations can be a welcome break from the more worrisome topics that are often playing in our head. What most of us find especially therapeutic are the in-depth talks that achieve at a minor level what professionals like Seremi and Fredendall provide. As with seeing a therapist, having to come up with the words to describe your problems forces you to better define exactly what's troubling you. And sometimes, that's all you want or need, a chance to vent, to articulate what's bothering you, and to feel that someone else understands you. That's how I've most benefited from oh-so-patient running partners. I'm usually not looking to them for solutions to such matters as fraying familial ties, the built-in sadness of knowing your pet will die in the next decade, or the dissatisfying difference in all creative projects between what you envision and what you produce. I just want to express aloud the thoughts that my mind plays whack-a-mole with in the middle of the night. Other times, you are looking for answers, or at least a sense of how someone else would approach a situation. One of my running partners, Meredith Anderson, says that running with others helps with her anxiety because she hears other perspectives. People are asking me questions, or they're not seeing things the same way I am. It's like a grounding, bringing me back from my tendency to let things spiral out of control. I think, oh, that's how a normal person would look at this. I found that mobile talk therapy works best when running with 1 to 3 others. On larger group runs, it's natural for small packs to form and shift throughout the run. Sustained conversation with the same person or people the whole time is unlikely. The more people there are on the run, the greater the chance that someone is outside the circle of intimacy that a topic initiator might be comfortable with. With no more than a handful of close friends on the run, you know the boundaries and can talk more openly. The 2 runs are like the difference between joining colleagues at a bar after work and having coffee with a couple of close friends. There's some self-efficacy involved in benefiting from run talks with others. When I've been in regular therapy, I look forward to the sessions. It feels as if I'm doing something about my situation. Even when it seems we talk about the same things week after week, I have the same anticipation of runs with good friends when I'm struggling mentally. It's not that I head to the run planning to monopolize it with my woes, but there's a good chance at some point the Scott finds reality disappointing topic will get some coverage. Just knowing that will occur makes things better. For the first part of my running life, these conversations were almost entirely with men my age. When I could break 31 minutes for 10 kilometers, the only people to train with were other young men. One of the great joys of getting older and slower, okay, maybe the only joy, has been an expanding pool of potential running partners. Over the last decade, I've morphed into someone who runs almost entirely with women. I've also increasingly leaned on running with others as a form of talk therapy. Here's why the first development has greatly enhanced the effectiveness of the second. Deborah Tannen is a linguist who is perhaps best known for her book, You Just Don't Understand, Women and Men in Conversation. My key takeaway from reading the book, which I first read a quarter century ago, was that men and women can have fundamentally different goals in conversation. According to Tannen, men approach conversation as an exchange of information. There's often an underlying competition to establish a pecking order when men talk. Tannen says that women see conversation more as a chance to bond. Empathy, not one-upmanship, is usually the underlying ethos. These different approaches can lead to classic misunderstandings. For example, Tannen says that if a woman describes a problem at work to her husband, he's likely to offer solutions. The woman might then think the man isn't really listening to her. His hastily offered advice implies that her problem is easily solved, when what she really wants from the conversation is empathetic support. Conversely, Tannen says, if a man brings up a work problem with his wife, she might respond by relating a similar incident she's experienced. The man might then get frustrated because he's looking for a solution, but instead, he thinks, his wife has turned the conversation into one about her. A side note. Tannen describes how videos of boys talking to each other tend to show them side by side, looking ahead, whereas videos of girls conversing usually show them facing each other. This could be a way for boys to be more expressive than they would comfortably be when looking at each other. If so, it supports Saremi's idea that some of us might be more open with each other running because our gaze is mostly focused frontward. The gist is that running with women has helped me deal with depression much more than running with men used to do. I'm speaking on average here. I have a few longtime male running friends I can also talk with like this, but we see each other only once or twice a year. The conversations I have now with the women my wife calls your girlfriends have bolstered me through many difficult days. They've also laid the foundation for strong friendships that carry over into our sedentary hours. My life has been enriched by these relationships in a way that wasn't the case when I mostly valued training partners for help getting through tough workouts. If you're fortunate to have running partners like mine, they might provide all the talk therapy you need for your depression or anxiety. It's not a knock on them if you need professional help. Therapy is a very specific kind of relationship where the therapist is not getting their needs met at that time, Saremi says. When you're with somebody who's not a therapist, you can't really expect that from them. It's more reciprocal. Hopefully, you take turns talking through things. There are certain responsibilities and interventions that a therapist has in mind and is doing that your running buddy is not. Fredendall agrees. The dialogue with others about what's occurring in our lives is extremely important, she says. But sometimes what's needed is an objective observer saying, are you still not feeling good? Is exercise not enough? That therapy can add something to what you get from talking with your running friends. I don't have a problem when people say, running is my therapy, Saremi says. But I think that if you have something serious going on, maybe find a therapist as well. Clearly, the talking is very helpful for you. If you're getting benefits while doing it with running partners, why not try it with a professional? You might get a little farther. If you see a professional, one technique you might be encouraged to try is cognitive behavioral therapy. That's the subject of the next chapter. Chapter 7. Running and Cognitive Behavioral Therapy. Imagine yourself in the final mile of a 5K. You've been operating near your aerobic maximum for the last several minutes. Maintaining a nice quick pop gets more difficult with each foot strike. Your chest feels as if a crate is slowly being lowered onto it. Then, someone passes you. It's not a blow-by-you pass, but a gradual inching away. If you were watching the race on TV, you'd think, the guy getting passed should tuck in behind her and get pulled to a faster time. But you're not watching.